I'm Robin Goodman. I'm the director of the literature program. I want to thank you all for coming out. I want to thank David Eichert for putting this event together, and Bob Butler for his generosity every year in funding this event out of his expense budget, and Bob Sloan, of course, for coming. Without more ado, I give you David Eichert.
Welcome. First, let me thank Scott for his tireless effort and being the man behind the scenes and putting things together and making sure that the right people were talking to the right people, that things were getting done, that transportation was being taken care of. And as any of you who have had the pleasure of working with Scott knows, that when you have somebody who is so competent and so hardworking, it makes your job easy. And this has certainly been the case with Scott. So, if we can give Scott a hand here, show some love for Scott in that regard, because it is work, and in a lot of times it's thankless work. I have the pleasure of introducing Bob Sloan to you, who is the acquisition editor at Indiana University Press. Bob is wanted to let you know that he is ABD English. He is one of us, so that is very good to know. So when those of you who will be meeting with him one-on-one tomorrow can know that he speaks your language. He's been in publishing for 30 years. He's been at Indiana University Press for 26 of those years. He started off with Macmillan Publishing in sales, particularly in terms of hawking textbooks, and moved on into this position in terms of publishing that he has been for more than two decades. He is also my point person for my Obama book, which is coming out in June, and my dealings with Bob in the process of bringing my book to life. I found him to be such a compelling, personable, smart individual that when we started talking about who we could potentially bring to come talk to us, that he came immediately to mind. And so without further ado, Bob Sloan.
Thank you, David. After lunch today, I realized that a lot of what I had put together in this presentation might be too, depressing and cynical. So what I may do is have a dialogue with this piece. We'll just have to see how things play out. The topic of this talk and dozens and dozens of other talks live in the Chronicle and other places is the future of the scholarly book. And what is that future? Well, that depends on who you ask and what you believe after they tell you what they think. Like any sort of forecasting, nobody can really offer anything more than some kind of informed speculation, which, as you know, hasn't prevented dozens of pundits from confidently predicting what that future will be. And in this talk, I don't intend to join the ranks of those pundits. What I want to do mostly is talk about the current state of scholarly publishing and how speculation about the digital future is shaping discussions within that industry about the future of scholarly presses. We know that certain aspects of the larger world of publishing, of which scholarly publishing is a very small part, are going through a period of rapid change. The two most important agents of this change are those that are represented by the collapse of borders, as previously Borders and Barnes & Noble had caused the collapse of many small bricks and mortar mom-and-pop bookstores, coupled with the rise to dominance of online booksellers such as Amazon and Barnes & Noble trying to save themselves by becoming online an online bookstore. And second, by the emergence and rapid growth of electronic distribution of books to e-book readers. It's very important that we are clear about what we're talking about, which I'll say more than once. I should probably add a third, which is the growth of the notion of free access to everything, which is the culture of the web. And that clearly plays a role in how people are thinking, especially people outside presses, think about what those presses ought to be doing. So while these things have been going on, we've seen steady reductions in book sales to academic libraries. This has actually been going on for 25 years. The more recent declines are to academic libraries are the result, it is said, of predatory European journal publishers and the inability of American university libraries to negotiate anything resembling reasonable contracts with them. And that may be changing, but we'll see. And at the same time, weakening institutional support for university presses. And that's due to various pressures on the university and its budget, and it comes as no surprise to any of you here. All of these forces have created new levels of anxiety in people like me about the future of scholarly publishing, and maybe similar anxieties in you, but certainly in people like me. Though the current climate is difficult, and I'll speak more about that in a moment, is there something worse coming next? Or something better? I'm sorry, I'm supposed to be dialoguing with this. Is there some wonderful saving technology, we'll say, on the horizon? Well, for some new technologies that are subsumed under what I find the unhelpful category of electronic publishing, or what's called in some quarters the dissemination of scholarly communication, and the role of the university press in the dissemination of scholarly information. According to these folks, in the future there will be no books if what we mean by book is the print-on-paper bound codex that we're all familiar with. In this view, the books will continue to be published, but they'll be available to be read only on devices that can display them. And we appear well on our way to that future. In the technologically advanced West, it's time for a drink. About 20% of book purchases today are for e-books. Digital transmission and display of text may signal a radical change in the reading habits of people, especially in the West at the moment, but soon all around the world. But it need not be the case that such a change will threaten scholarly publishing. Theoretically, it shouldn't. It just means there are more audiences who will be reading books, but in a different form. For some, the book itself, if what we mean by book, is a text consisting of a sustained argument or an analysis of a delimited subject or a long narrative synthesis or any of those long forms. This sort of book may well be headed to the remainder bin of history, to be not so much replaced as rendered unnecessary by the global access to information that's made possible by the web and similar technologies. Now, librarians and futurists of various stripes are very attracted by this scenario. Academic librarians welcome the notion of open access to information as the best means of furthering scholarly communication. They also don't have to figure out ways to store all those damn books. And I don't know what your library is like, but you walk into the library at Indiana University, it's walking into a computer lab. I mean, that's essentially what it is. I think there are books there somewhere. Books in the sense of bound codex. Data miners at Google and others armed with very liberal notions of what constitutes intellectual property are rapidly moving forward to accomplish their mission, as they see it, of providing electronic access to the data locked away on paper between boards. And we shouldn't stop there. Some people strongly advocate making globally available all information stored, freshly uploaded in all languages, natural, mathematical, or machine, throughout the world. If it's attached to the web, traveling through the air, visible from the ground, or by a Google truck going through your neighborhood, it should be, can be, and will be made freely available to everyone. Although some laws, firewalls, anti-spyware software, stand in the way of this wholesale grabbing of data of all sorts, there doesn't seem to be anything particularly speculative about the likelihood of this sort of future. And we see it, you know, in the headlines daily, whether it's WikiLeaks or something else more sinister. In fact, the data deluge is already overwhelming. And if it's facts that you want, they're just a Google search away. It's not this sort of technological future that's the cause for concern for publishers of scholarship. At least I don't think so. Or this isn't the only concern. College enrollments in the humanities and social sciences are down, especially in graduate programs. I wonder why. So that the nurturing ground for future scholars in such fields as literature, history, philosophy, foreign language, classics, you name it, are drying up. And along with those students, drying up students, that doesn't work, does it? The audiences for the scholarly work that this diminishing cohort will produce is also drying up. In other words, it might not be a question of scholarly book publishing being overtaken by faster, more efficient, and more economical ways of delivering scholarly communication. There may not be enough scholars with whom to communicate. Everyone may be, one day, Sarah Palin. I'm sorry, I just got her on my mind. I could pick many, many other people, the governor of your fine state and others. You might want to erase that. At this point, you might be prompted to ask, and you would not be the first, then what makes you think publishing has a future? Let alone the little segment of it called scholarly publishing. And in fact, not a few university vice presidents and provosts have voiced similar questions, frequently after reviewing the university press's budget. and its balance sheet. And many of these same individuals have concluded that the business model of the university press, and I hope it doesn't come as a surprise that a university press is a business, as poorly run as they may be, anyway, that the business model is just not sustainable. In fact, the vice president or a vice president at my university has predicted that within 3 years, because our business model isn't sustainable, we will be gone. And this does not give one warm fuzzies about the administration, since he is one of the people who could make us gone, should he choose to. Anyway, unless university presses radically transform themselves, it is argued, within a very short time, that they're doomed. Now, various solutions to a problem that goes by the name of the crisis in scholarly communication have been proposed. And as I've hinted at earlier, your preferred solution or group of solutions very much depends upon how you define the problem. If the problem is one of access, then a solution is at hand. All that's necessary is the requisite number of computers throughout the globe, sufficient infrastructure and bandwidth, which is retarding growth in Africa and Idaho, and the digitization and cataloging or tagging of all the information produced on Earth, past, present, and future. It sounds like a daunting task, of course, but it nonetheless sets the eyes of information imperialists and grant writers ablaze. It leads to talk of the universal library, of search engines that know what you are thinking, and at some point in the not too distant future of the singularity, the computing cloud that attains self-consciousness, a bit like a digital version of James Lovelock's Gaia or Star Trek Next Gen's Borg. I'm not sure what the rest of us will be doing at that point, if we have a universal thinking being machine, watching our gardens, I suppose. Anyway, I want to propose a different way of looking at the issue. I want to turn away from the notion of communication, scholarly or otherwise, or access to information, or whatever word you want to use. And I also want to foolishly turn away from that machine that can think for itself and for you and for me. Instead, I want to frame the discussion in terms of what it means to produce knowledge, heaven forfend, and what it means to publish it. Since I'm not a wide-eyed futurist, because I'm over 60, I guess, I don't know, this reframing puts me on safer, more familiar ground. I have no intention of talking about what knowledge is or what it means to produce it. I'm not going to suggest that even if I can't tell you what knowledge is, I know it when I see it. I simply want to distinguish knowledge from information and facts and data. My friend Scott Sanders, the writer, can speak eloquently about the path from fact or data to knowledge to wisdom. I'm not going to do that either. Let's just say that to produce knowledge is to make facts meaningful. Let's also grant, for the sake of argument, that this act of making meaning is done not by a computing machine, but by human beings, for other human beings. Similarly, I want to distinguish scholarly publishing from scholarly communication or open access to information, or the information specifically provided by scholars. The word publishing is bandied about rather freely these days in discussions of this sort. To place something on one's Facebook page is to publish it. To provide web access to a text is to publish it. to create an electronic repository of information is to publish it. There's also the notion of self-publishing, which usually means taking advantage of all the pseudo typesetting options available in Word and finding some ways of sending it out to friends who really don't want to read it. Although self-publishing can also mean paying someone for all the services a publisher can provide. And that's what I'm going to talk about for a little bit. What do publishers do? My dean wants to know. And I'm going to tell you. What publishing really is a set of activities, all of them important and all of them necessary to the task of what I know as publishing. And all of them are centered on a text. We can identify these tasks in a kind of abstract, generalized way as selecting, shaping, displaying and packaging, getting the word out, and making available, in our case, making available the knowledge produced by a scholar, and I may as well add it now, for a price. These tasks or functions correspond to what you know as acquisitions, manuscript preparation, copy editing, book design, typesetting, composition, proofreading, printing, binding, warehousing, marketing, selling, and maintaining financial accounts, to say nothing of relations with authors. If what you're doing does not include each one of these, then what you're talking about is not publishing. It's something else. So let me for a moment pass over the first of these tasks, selection, which is likely the most problematic function performed by the scholarly publisher and the one you're most interested in. Let's begin instead with shaping. Contributing to shaping a scholar's work can begin as early as a conversation about a project or reviewing a proposal, a book proposal, and it continues through peer review of the manuscript into copy editing and presumably into discussions that the writer has with his colleagues or her colleagues, with reviewers and so forth, and with readers. These engagements with work are interventions of greater or lesser extent aimed at improving the ability of the work to communicate with its readers. These interventions may have less impact on the shape of the work than the author's interactions with friends, colleagues, and spouses, but they are important nonetheless. Obviously, some very important works of scholarship will always remain more or less opaque to readers. We publish a lot of Heidegger. Some thoughts are difficult to express, and bad writing and bad writers are just there, and there's not very much one can do about them. But a publisher's engagement with the text is a very valuable service. Display. Now, we think now of display as what happens on the screen of a computer, but in fact, information is displayed and has been displayed since the beginning of writing. And anyone who's done any study in looking at texts, looking at scribal habits and whatnot, knows that there's good display and bad display. And the same thing is true in book publishing. I don't know whether it surprises you to learn that in the digital age, the AAUP, the Association of American University Presses, continues to hold an annual book and jacket design contest. Why? Because it matters how a text is displayed, even if most readers remain unaware of the book designer's craft, as they probably should be unaware. It's usually when something goes very wrong that readers notice. And, you know, we could talk about those things, but then they would get fairly arcane. But if you see what seems to be rivers running down the page, something's gone wrong in the composition. E-readers may have some way to go right now on those terms before their displays of text are as transparent as the average printed book. In any case, nearly all university presses still care about these things, although the digital age is putting them at risk. One aspect of the process where university presses fall short is getting the word out, and that's simply because they don't have the money or the reach of a commercial publisher. But here, the digital revolution is lending a hand, and we've talked about this, which is that social networking is a wonderful way to promote your books. And letting your friends know, and blogging about them, and creating websites, sometimes about the book itself. I've published at least one book based on a website. YouTube, MySpace, Twitter, blogging, even that old-fashioned thing called email is a great way to reach new audiences and increase sales, and costs very little, and it costs the publisher basically nothing, which is delightful. Now, I'm one of the people who still prefers to get catalogs in the mail, but that's just me. You know, I like, if I can see it in front of me, eventually I'll pick it up, and who knows, maybe I'll order something from Amazon. Presses are good at making texts available, getting books to customers, even if they don't do it as quickly as their commercial colleagues, and they can't do it as quickly as current digital technology. But all presses, and university presses are no different, are making those texts available. We've done it for years in, you know, kind of clumsy PDF form to libraries. Library aggregators have been grabbing up university press publications to fill the academic libraries, and we are all in the process of digitizing first the books that are being published today, and as we can and can afford to do it, the backlist. And that is a little complicated today because we seem to be in a situation reminiscent of the old Betamax, VHS, you know, battle of the formats. There has been an attempt and a resolution to have a standard format, but Apple, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and the rest of those guys don't seem to be quite aware of it. So when you do a digital book, you have to create it in more than one format to get it out there. And of course, all these things are available as real books, hardbacks, paperbacks, large print books, braille books, audio books, you name it. So having made this distinction, or tried to make this distinction between publishing and just communicating or disseminating, maybe I should ask whether there's any point in distinguishing what a university press does from any other publisher. Or university press is a special kind of publishing animal. Are they worthy being kept alive for that reason? Or should this beast be allowed to go extinct? The press's justification for continued existence is that it adds value to scholars' works. That this is what sets it apart and gives it a distinctive role to play in the intellectual life of the global community, or less grandly, in the intellectual life of the modern academy, or even less grandly as part of the tenure and promotion system. But does that special role mean that it is allowed to ask for special protection, in this case from the profit and loss economy? Or instead, are university presses failing the intellectual community, or the academy, or the academy's tenure and promotion system, by failing to continue to find ways to successfully commercialize scholarly knowledge? In other words, is it our problem that we haven't found the right ways to keep the money flowing in to support the scholarly publishing enterprise? And that seems to be the heart of the crisis today. If our primary mission is to select and publish the best which has been thought and said, to produce books of importance and lasting value, to publish for the ages, we must certainly add the caveat that books must pay their way. And in large measure, it's always been this way. There's nothing particularly new about the idea that a university press should at least strive to be self-supporting. But it's just true that that goal has become very difficult. Some would argue almost impossible to achieve. It's hard to completely agree with that because, you know, there are successful university presses out there. Maybe one year they're not, but, you know, they'll be back. There are changes in the book market, obviously. There are changes in library buying habits. There's the decline in those subjects that have best been served by university presses. We know about all that. The economic collapse of 2008 has cut into the disposable income of book buyers, turned up the financial heat on universities and state legislatures, and getting additional support from a university for almost anything is out of the question, unless it has a uniform. Actually, I think some uniforms don't even work. Unless it has a certain kind of uniform. And the options available to the press are very limited. It's not just the case that the knowledge that flows from the humanities and social sciences is hard to monetize. In the current Harper's, Lewis Lapham observes that the Florida State University football coach earns more than its entire classics department. Now, not only does such a statement not raise an eyebrow, probably not even, certainly in this crew, but we are probably supposed to be grateful that there still is a classics department at FSU. And with some generosity of spirit, we can do our best not to blame its faculty for failing to turn the classics into a university cash cow. Now, the English department, that's a whole different thing. In the past, university presses have responded to such fiscal pressures by creative list management, sometimes by downsizing, but usually by creative list management, which means that they will add or expand, usually regional trade publishing, but trade publishing of a certain sort. They'll publish books that nobody would claim, or, well, that's a little unfair. They would publish books that at least are not monographs. Let me put it that way. We do stuff like train books. The guys out there, and I think they're all guys, who are interested in trains, in model trains, in the history of trains, although they are aging, they buy books. Bless their pointed little heads. We published a book which had nothing more than really just a list of all the routes in the state of Indiana. We printed very conservatively. I don't even know we printed 500 copies. You know, it's in its third substantial printing. I don't know why. But it's important. In the past, they've also done things that you all know about, trying to ride the latest theoretical wave from France. Opening lists to new, more fashionable subject areas, and this goes way, 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 way back. You name it, presses were trying to be there early when a new field was emerging and growing, and they continue to do it, and it's one of the wonderful things that they do. And one of its side benefits is that these kind of books tend to sell better than other kinds of monographic studies. It takes time to write and publish a book is the only downside of that. And even in pre-blogging days, it was hard to publish right at the cutting edge of academic fashion. Journals had a leg up, for one thing, but now everybody has a leg up. An editor for a well-respected commercial scholarly press once said that he didn't care if he published the best book in a new or emerging field, as long as it was the first book. Today it might still be possible to publish that trend-setting volume, but chances are that you would have already been scooped somewhere in cyberspace, and the publisher would have to be satisfied with bringing the news to those readers hopelessly mired in print culture. Now, I don't think I believe that after our lunchtime conversation, because there have been things that have appeared electronically in blog spaces and whatnot that have done extremely well when they got transformed into regular everyday books. Now, logic would tell you, at least technologic would tell you, that all that stuff had already been seen and was still available for free out there, but somehow the books could still sell and make bestseller lists in some cases. So I want to now turn to what I referred to earlier as the problematic nature of selection of the acquisition of manuscripts. And I should probably let you interrupt me at any point at this stage to talk about what the hell are you guys doing in there? Once upon a time, what was problematic about university press acquisitions was that it was said to be functioning as a gatekeeper. The idea was that university presses, and this wasn't necessarily a bad thing, it was kind of an okay thing. The idea was that university presses were especially set up to select only the best scholarship, because almost uniquely, they would do such things as hire expert readers, reviewers, to advise them on which manuscripts to acquire and which ones to reject, and that these selections would undergo additional scrutiny by the press's advisory board, where further winnowing could occur, and perhaps for reasons that were not necessarily scholarly, but we're protecting the press's reputation in the academy. I mean, do you really want to publish, you know, Henry Miller? This is a recent. In short, unworthy projects would be weeded out in favor of the academically distinguished. You know, peer reviewing has other functions, of course, and provides useful feedback to authors and so forth, but I just want to focus on the acquisitions part for the moment. The idea of this sort of selection process seems reasonable enough, but alas, nothing in the academy is as reasonable as it seems, or as it tells itself, or as it tells its constituent, or as it appears in their catalogs. After all, the gatekeepers are human, all too human, and the checks and balances in the system are about as reliable as those currently at play among the three branches of the government of these United States. There are just too many non-academic factors at work. We've been harping on the money part, but in no particular order, these include the judgment of the acquisitions editor, which on any given day can be inspired or hopelessly muddle-headed, or just plain stupid. The specific vision that he or she has of the kind of list that he or she wants to build, or that there's a current enthusiasm that the editor shares with a bunch of people at the press, and they all convince themselves that, yeah, let's do this. Sometimes that's great. Sometimes that's cuckoo. There are ways to mitigate the blindness and insight of editors, the oversight of editorial directors, or internal review boards, for example, or the use of series editors as screens, although series editors have also been known to operate with something less than objectivity. Then there's the history of the press itself and its publishing programs. It's absolutely true that in publishing, the past isn't even past, and like Benjamin's angel of history, the tendency is to move into the future by looking backward. Editors are constantly asked to compare a current project with a similar project that was published sometime in the past. This is inevitable. In fact, the systems that are set up to do these sorts of things include, here are the similar titles that we've published, here are the similar titles that other presses have published. How many did we print? How many did they print? What was the price? What was the discount? Were we able to successfully market the thing? Did it make us any money? Are these apples and oranges? Apples and apples? Neither? Not only does doing something new require an editorial sales job, I mean a sales job by the editors, it requires risk-taking and very likely an investment of very scarce resources. Most presses can strike off in new directions only at the expense of some other part of their program. And part of the cost of doing so may be offending an author or a faculty member or who knows what. So for the most part, university presses are inherently conservative organizations. Once started, publishing programs are hard to abandon. Once abandoned, they're hard to revive. And new programs nearly always face a good deal of internal resistance, especially any move into an unfamiliar realm. Among university presses, the most unfamiliar realm seems to be STM publishing, science, technical, and medical publishing. Some presses do it successfully, and others, because the staff are all ABDs in English, are not skilled at doing this kind of publishing. Today, there are 134 presses affiliated with the American Association of University Presses. That number includes some foreign publishers and a few presses not affiliated with any university, some, you know, RAND Corporation, that sort of thing. In 2011, these presses published 12,034 titles. I counted them myself. If we count only the university presses in North America, but include Oxford and Oxford's 1,320 titles published in 2011, and Cambridge, who lists their number of publications as over 2,000. I guess they're not even sure. The number of university presses then falls to 105, and the number of titles published to 10,764. But we should compare that number with the estimated 500,000 titles published each year in combined in the United States, Canada, and the United Kingdom. 500,000 new titles. And we're just trying to find our little place. Although the number of these titles includes paperback reissues and so forth, 10,000 plus new slots for scholarly work. You know, you wouldn't think that finding a university press to publish your book would be all that difficult. Of course, what these statistics don't tell you are how many of those titles are scholarly monographs, and my guess is that maybe a quarter of them are. Maybe it's bigger than that. Even so, it doesn't sound as though gatekeeping is the operative word. Some of the available gates are flooded with manuscripts, and somewhat by default, publishers will act to restrict the number of titles published in those areas, presumably by selecting the best. But other gates are effectively shut, or will admit only very few titles. And that means that if you work in certain areas of study, you will discover a very high degree of selectivity indeed. English departments are probably filled with those areas of study, but there are still places that will publish them. Again, how much of this selection occurs strictly on the basis of scholarly merit? Well, if the gate has been shut because the university press doesn't think they can, you know, support your kind of publishing, it ain't scholarly merit that's making them do that. Other factors. Modestly sized books by established authors on broad topics in popular or other subject areas that were previously successful for that press will have an advantage over long, narrowly conceived books by first-timers. Complicated, heavily illustrated, specialized books with quotations in foreign languages, especially non-Western ones, may lose out to their less complicated cousins. A book by a single author might be preferred to a multi-authored collection. This may be gatekeeping, but it's not the sort that's primarily performed in the service of scholarship. And yet it would be very disingenuous to pretend that such extra academic concerns do not play a role. And I'd like to think not the significant role, but they certainly play a role in what's chosen for publication. To a greater or lesser degree, scholarly publishers have always had to make such decisions, and now they must be even more careful in what they choose to publish, and most definitely, how many specialized books they can take on. There's a strong fiscal need to balance specialized titles with more popular work. And by popular, I don't mean, you know, Stephen King. What I mean, the ideal book, presumably, if we're not talking, you know, regional books of, or books with pictures of trains or whatnot, is a book that takes a subject and explains it in such a way that a non-specialist can at least have the opportunity of understanding it. The more arcane the subject matter, the more important it is to look above the horizon and try to speak to people who are not specialists in your area, whether that area means a particular writer or, these days, a particular jargon. You can use the jargon somewhat. You just have to explain it, or people will just close the book. And I can't account for how many of those books are out there. And I guess some of them are very successful because people keep buying them because somebody else says that this is this and this is that, and they sit on the shelf, and every once in a while you pick them up and you try to get through them, and then you say, I can't use it. Or you'll find a couple of pages that make sense to you, and that will be what's taken into your, I've got Foucault in here, Derrida, you know, you name it, or Heidegger. Heidegger makes us a lot of money, too. I mean, I don't get it. You know, the man only published a few books while he was alive. And all this other stuff, and there've got to be, I don't know, 120 volumes in the collected Heidegger. These are just notes that were put together by his students. I mean, that's all they are. They're lectures. I can't imagine sitting in an audience listening to a Heidegger lecture. If this is... Never mind. I just don't have an ear for Heidegger. I guess that's what it is. Okay. Where was we? Oh, we were going to say the obvious, which is that all these pressures are small comfort for faculty members or newly minted PhDs faced with the demand for book publication in order to advance in their chosen professions. You know, no shit. Can electronic publication help ease this situation? Let's pass over whether one day a hiring, tenure, or promotion committee will actually accept an electronic publication as a real publication. if it's been published in the way I've said, does it matter in what form it's been published? If it's been uploaded onto the web, it ain't been published. Somebody needs to understand that. Although I will say that being able to publish print-on-demand stuff makes it a little bit easier if you need to show somebody, here's a book. You know, press will print 15 of them for you, or LSI will print 15 of them for you, and you'll have it. It's a serious issue, obviously. Whether the bookbag public, or for that matter, the author, will settle for ebook publication only is another matter again. As I said earlier, about 20% of the books currently purchased these days are electronic. And I imagine that a small proportion of those are actually scholarly books. I mean, most people buy, purchase electronic books to read on airplanes. And it's what they always read on airplanes. It's, you know, Pulp Fiction and Bodice Rippers and that kind of stuff. The real problem is that printing and binding is only a relatively small portion, less than a third of the, this is just throwing a number out. Less than a third of the $18,000 cost of publishing 700 copies of a simple, no art, no special anything, 240-page monograph. If we wish to abandon all that other publisher stuff, and the expectations of our academic audience, and the idea that we can, that what we publish is meant, if not for the ages, at least for longer than the average bestseller, and that books must pay their way, then yes, making scholarly work available is made very much easier in the digital age. The tensions among academic tradition, and I don't just mean, you know, in-house, I mean your academic traditions. The lure of new technologies and the financial realities of both scholarly book publishing and the modern university are very significant and not easily relieved. For their part, university presses are trying to make the best use of technology, to reduce cost, improve workflow, to reach out to new audiences through new means, respond to book buyer demands for a variety of formats, including the new electronic ones. So far, these responses have been inadequate in stemming declines in sales and the resulting increase in red ink. People are still, and I will welcome it, but people are still expecting that electronic publication, reading on your iPad, iPhone, whatever, will increase sales of books. And I hope so. I am very suspicious that they'll increase sales of scholarly books. I think we're just an old fogey print culture. We like the feel, smell, and navigability of print on paper. But I know that's an older person talking. When I look at a Kindle, I don't see my library. I don't even visualize what's in that Kindle. In fact, sometimes I'll pull up the menu and say, when did I download that? Well, when I started and there were free things and, you know, you sort of got into it. When I go into my library with the books lying all over the place, I may not access any of them. I may have even lost a few, only to rediscover them. But at least I can see them, and the guilt that they present. Why haven't you read me? Why did you buy me? Why is there a Heidegger book on my shelf? I've already mentioned some of the other possible responses to this crisis. These include reducing the number of monographs published, increasing the number of books aimed at general audiences, altering the acquisitions programs to cease publishing in disciplines with weak sales, and reducing the number of copies printed of any given title, raising prices, and so forth. One thing I haven't mentioned, but which could bring some immediate relief, is direct small-scale financial support for publication. A grant of $3,000 or $5,000 goes a long way toward underwriting a monograph. And while support of this sort cannot and should never play a role in a decision-making at a university press, I have grown very comfortable, I guess, asking an author whether the home institution has any grant money that they make available, especially to first-time authors, that can be used as a publication subvention. I think such support represents a way for universities to show support for their faculty, and it should be part of every department's budget. The argument could also be made that the number of colleges and universities requiring book publication by faculty far exceeds the number of universities with presses, and that it only seems fair for those institutions to help to contribute support to the scholarly publishing enterprise in some way. Make that argument to your dean. Good luck. Other solutions have been proposed. Why, for example, don't presses consolidate? Why are there two presses competing for a book on Alexander Pope? Why don't there just be one? Why don't they share resources? You guys do the acquisitions and we'll do the design, okay? Okay. The notion is that each press could benefit from economies of scale or by specializing in the most efficient means of fulfilling one or more of the publisher's essential tasks. And, you know, there are such things out there. There are shared warehouses and order fulfillment facilities. Chicago has one. North Carolina has one called Longleaf Publishing, or Longleaf something or other. It's a warehouse. But although these arrangements can reduce a certain amount of overhead, you know, you don't pay staff, you don't have a building, you don't have to heat it, so forth, you know, a warehouse, they generally have a positive cash flow benefit only to the press who provides the service. To date, proposals to consolidate or share resources have run up against the impermeable barriers that exist in every institution. For logistical reasons, for fears of losing, you know, the press's individual identity. I mean, can you, the state of Florida started by having a university press for all the presses of Florida. Colorado has a similar arrangement. I think those are the only ones. But where the university press has already begun and it's already established itself, I mean, can you imagine Illinois and Indiana cooperating on anything, let alone sharing resources and acquisitions and so forth? Who would get the money? Who would get the credit? Who would have the name at the bottom of the page? Some have suggested presses could make extra revenue by becoming service providers, by marketing their expertise to others, both within and outside of the university. Or contrarily, perhaps they should outsource as many tasks as possible, thereby reducing labor and overhead costs. And the vision that comes to mind is like of a storefront with a desk in it, and everything else is outsourced. One suggestion is that presses should create new product lines. These are just things I've heard, and I've heard them spoken seriously by, you know, people who should know better. Create new publishing lines, new product lines, I mean. But I'll give a publishing example. It's okay. Perhaps publishing textbooks written by faculty for courses taught at the home institution. There is an example at the University of Florida Press. But there's also an assumption here, which is that the individual who's written the textbook would prefer to have it published by the local university press to be used freely, really, at the local university, instead of having the expertise and the muscle and all the rest of that from a big textbook publisher who's able to publish it not only for the students on that university, but throughout the country, sometimes throughout the world. The guy who wrote the textbook that's now the best-selling textbook in economics got a $2 million advance from his publisher. $2 million advance. This is a guy with the unpronounceable name from Harvard. It's a short name, but it's still hard to pronounce. And he's part of, you know, the Reagan Revolution. And he updates that book, you know, every year. And the latest update has a itty-bitty little paragraph about why it was that in 2008 everything went to hell. Wasn't his fault. He probably made a lot of money. Okay, I'm ready. I've knocked over my mic. Anyway, try to find some way to generate new income for the press. Meanwhile, the underpaid and vastly overworked staffs of university presses will soldier on. At the end of the day, it's likely to be the academy, not, I hope, represented exclusively by budget-obsessed administrators, and the marketplace, not necessarily the marketplace of ideas, but probably the cash-and-carry marketplace. In other words, forces that are beyond control of the university press, or your control for that matter, unless you buy all the books that are available. It'll be those forces that'll determine whether university presses will continue to exercise an important role in the intellectual life of the 21st century. Thank you.